and boots missing laces. Nothing like the fine clothes I found in a silver cell, but they feel right against my skin. I barely have the shirt over my head when my compartment door bangs open on great iron hinges. Killorn waits expectantly on the other side, his smile forced and grim. He shouldn't blush, having seen me in various stages of undress for many summers, but his cheeks redden anyway. "It's not like you to sleep so long," he says, and I hear worry in his voice. I shrug it off and stand on weak legs. I guess I needed it. An odd ringing in my ears takes hold, piercing but not painful. I shake my head back and forth, trying to get rid of it, looking like a wet dog in the process. "That'll be the banshee scream." He crosses to me and takes my head in gentle but calloused hands. I submit to his examination, sighing in annoyance. He turns me sideways, glancing at ears that ran red with blood however long ago. "You're lucky it didn't hit you head on." "I'm a lot of things, but I don't think lucky is one of them." "You're alive, Mare," he says sharply, pulling away. "That's more than many can say." His glare brings me back to Naersi, when I told my brother I didn't trust his word. Deep in my heart, I know I still don't. "I'm sorry," I mutter quickly. "Of course I know others have died, for the cause and for me. But I've died too. Mare of the Stilts died the day she fell onto a lightning shield. Marina, the lost Silver Princess, died in the Bowl of Bones. And I don't know what new person opened her eyes on the undertrain. I only know what she has been and what she has lost, and the weight of it is almost crushing. Are you going to tell me where we're going, or is that another secret? I try to keep the bitterness from my voice, but fail miserably. Killorn is polite enough to ignore it and leans back against the door. "We left Naersi 5 hours ago and we're headed northeast. That's honestly all I know." "And that doesn't bother you at all?" He only shrugs. "What makes you think the higher-ups trust me, or you for that matter? You know better than anyone how foolish we've been, and the high cost we've paid." Again, I feel the sting of memory. "You said yourself, you can't even trust Shade. I doubt anyone's going to be sharing secrets anytime soon." The jab doesn't hurt as much as I expected it to. "How is he?" Killorn tosses his head, gesturing out to the hallway. "Farley carved out a nice little medical station for the wounded. He's doing better than the others, cursing a lot, but definitely better." His green eyes darken a bit, and he turns his gaze away. "His leg," I drew in a startled breath. "Infected?" "At home in the Stilts, infection was as bad as a severed arm. We didn't have much medicine, and once the blood went bad, all you could do was keep chopping, hoping to outrun fever and blackened veins." To my relief, Killorn shakes his head. "No, Farley dosed him good. And the Silvers fight with clean bullets, so that's big of them." He laughs darkly, expecting me to join him. Instead, I shiver. The air is so cold down here. But he'll definitely be limping for a while. "Will you take me to him, or do I have to figure out the way myself?" Another dark laugh, and he extends his arm. To my surprise, I find that I need his support to help me walk. Naersi and the Bowl of Bones have certainly taken their toll. Mersive. That's what Killorn calls the strange underwater boat. How it manages to sail beneath the ocean is beyond both of us, though I'm sure Cal will figure it out. He's next on my list. I'll find him after I make sure my brother is still breathing. I remember Cal being barely conscious when we escaped, just like me. But I don't suppose Farley will set him up in the medical station, not with injured guardsmen all around. There's too much bad blood, and no one wants an inferno in a sealed metal tube. The banshee's scream still rings in my head, a dull whine that I try to ignore. And with every step, I learn about new aches and bruises. Killorn notes my every wince and slows his pace, allowing me to lean on his arm. He ignores his own wounds, deep cuts hidden beneath yet another set of fresh bandages. He always had battered hands, bruised and cut from fishing hooks and rope. but they were familiar wounds. They meant he was safe, employed, free from conscription. If not for one dead fishmaster, little Scars would be his only burden. Once that thought would have made me sad. Now I feel only rage. The main passage of the Mersive is long but narrow, divided by several metal doors with thick hinges and pressurized seals, to close off portions, if need be, to stop the entire vessel from flooding and sinking. But the doors give me no comfort whatsoever. I can't stop thinking about dying at the bottom of the ocean, locked in a watery coffin. Even Killorn, a boy raised on water, seems uncomfortable. The dim lights set into the ceiling filter strangely, cutting shadows across his face to make him appear old and drawn. The other guardsmen aren't so affected, coming and going with great purpose. Their red scarves and shawls have been lowered, revealing faces set in grim determination. They carry charts, trays of medical supplies, bandages, food, or even the occasional rifle down the passage, always hurrying and chattering to each other. But they stop at the sight of me, pressing back against the walls to give me as much room as possible in the narrow space. The more daring ones look me in the eye, watching me limp past, but most stare at their feet. A few even seem afraid. Of me. I want to say thank you, to somehow express how deeply indebted I am to every man and woman aboard this strange ship. Thank you for your service. Almost slips past my lips, but I clench my jaw to keep it back. Thank you for your service. It's what they print in the notices, the letters sent to tell you your children have died for a useless war. How many parents did I watch weep over those words? How many more will receive them when the measures send even younger children to the front? None, I tell myself. Farley will have a plan for that, just like we will come up with a way to find the new bloods, the others like me. We will do something. We must do something. The guardsmen against the wall mutter among themselves as I pass. Even the ones who can't stand to look at me whisper to one another, not bothering to mask their words. I suppose they think what they're saying is a compliment. The lightning girl echoes from them, bouncing off the metal walls. It surrounds me like Ilara's wretched whispers, ghosting into my brain. Little lightning girl, it's what she used to call me. What they called me. No, it isn't. Despite the pain, I straighten my spine, standing as tall as I can. I am not little anymore. The whispers follow us all the way to the medical station, where a pair of guardsmen keeps watch at the closed door. They're also watching the ladder, a heavy metal thing reaching up into the ceiling, the only exit and the only entrance in this slow bullet of a ship. One of the guards has dark red hair, just like Tristan, though he's nowhere near as tall. The other is built like a boulder, with brown skin, angled eyes, a broad chest, and massive hands better suited to a strong arm. They bow their heads at the sight of me, but to my relief, don't spare me much more than a glance. Instead, they turn their attentions to Killorn, grinning at him like school friends. "Back so soon, Warren?" the redhead chuckles, waggling his eyebrows in suggestion. "Lena's gone off her shift." "Lena?" Killorn tenses beneath my arm, but says nothing to betray his discomfort. Instead, he laughs along, grinning, but I know him better than any, enough to see the force behind his smile. To think he's been spending his time flirting while I've been unconscious, and Shade lies wounded and bleeding.
"The boy's got enough on his plate without chasing pretty nurses,"
the boulder says. His deep voice echoes down the passage, probably carrying all the way to Lena's quarters.
"Farley's still making rounds, if you're after her," he adds, jabbing a thumb at the door.
"And my brother?" I speak up, disentangling myself from Killorn's supporting grip. My knees almost buckle, but I stand firm. "Shade Barrow?" Their smiles fade, stiffening into something more formal. It's almost like being back in the Silver Court. The boulder grips the door, spinning the massive wheel lock so he doesn't have to look at me.
"He's recovering well, miss, my lady."
My stomach drops at the title. I thought I was done with such things. Please, call me Mayor.
Of course,
he replies without any kind of resolve. Though we are both part of the Scarlet Guard, soldiers together in our cause, we are not the same. This man and many others will never call me by my given name, no matter how much I want them to. He swings open the door with a tiny nod, revealing a wide but shallow compartment filled with bunks. Sleeping quarters at one time, but now the stacked beds are full of patients, the single aisle buzzing with men and women in white shifts. Many have clothes spattered with crimson blood, too preoccupied setting a leg or administering medication to notice me limping into their midst. Killorn's hand hovers by my waist, ready to catch me should I need him again, but I lean on the bunks instead. If everyone's going to stare at me, I might as well try to walk on my own. Shade props up against a single thin pillow, supported mostly by the sloping metal wall. He can't possibly be comfortable, but his eyes are closed and his chest rises and falls in the easy rhythm of sleep. Judging by his leg, suspended from the ceiling of his bunk by a hasty sling, and his bandaged shoulder, he's surely been medicated a few times. The sight of him so broken, even though I thought him dead just yesterday, is shockingly hard to bear. We should let him sleep, I murmur to no one in particular, expecting no answer.
Yes, please do, Shade says without opening his eyes, but his lips quirk into a familiar, mischievous smile.
Despite his grim, injured figure, I have to laugh. The trick is a familiar one. Shade would pretend to sleep through school or our parents' whispered conversations. I have to laugh at the memory, remembering how many little secrets Shade picked up in this particular way. I may have been born a thief, but Shade was born a spy. No wonder he ended up in the Scarlet Guard. Eavesdropping on nurses? My knee cracks as I sit on the side of his bunk, careful not to jostle him. Have you learned how many bandages they've got squirreled away? But instead of laughing at the joke, Shade opens his eyes. He draws Killorn and me closer with a beckoning hand.
The nurses know more than you think, he says, his gaze flickering toward the far end of the compartment.
I turn to find Farley busying herself over an occupied bunk. The woman in it is out cold, probably drugged, and Farley monitors her pulse closely. In this light, her scar stands out rudely, twisting one side of her mouth into a scowl before cutting down the side of her neck and under her collar. Part of it is split open and was hastily stitched up. Now the only red she wears is the swath of blood across her white nurse's shift, and the half-washed stains reaching to her elbows. Another nurse stands at her shoulder, but his shift is clean, and he whispers hurriedly in her ear. She nods occasionally, though her face tightens in anger.
What have you heard?
Killorn asks, shifting so that his body blocks Shade entirely. To anyone else, it looks like we're adjusting his bandages.
We're headed to another base, this time off the coast, outside Norton territory.
I strain to remember Julian's old map, but I can't think of much more than the coastline.
An island?
Shade nods.
Called Tuck. It must not be much, because the Silvers don't even have an outpost there. They've all but forgotten it.
Dread pools in my stomach. The prospect of isolating myself on an island with no means of escape scares me even more than the Mersive.
But they know it exists. That's enough. Farley seemed confident in the base there.
Killorn scoffs aloud.
I remember her thinking Naersi was safe, too.
It wasn't her fault we lost Naersi, I say. It's mine.
Maven tricked everyone, Mayor, Killorn replies, nudging my shoulder. He got past me, you, and Farley. We all believed in him.
With his mother to coach him, to read our minds and mold Maven to our hopes, it's no wonder we were all fooled. And now, he is king. Now he will fool and control our whole world.
What a world that will be, with a monster for its king, and his mother holding his leash.
But I push through such thoughts. They can wait. Did Farley say anything else? What about the list? She still has it, doesn't she? Shade watches over my shoulder, careful to keep his voice low.
She does, but she's more concerned with the others we're meeting in Tuck, Mom and Dad included.
A rush of warmth spreads through me, an invigorating curl of happiness. Shade brightens at the sight of my small but genuine smile, and he takes my hand.
Gisa, too, and the lumps we call brothers.
A cord of tension releases in my chest, but is soon replaced by another. I tighten my grip on him, one eyebrow raised in question.
Others? Who? How can that be?
After the massacre beneath Caesar Square and the evacuation of Nairsi, I didn't think anyone else existed. But Killorn and Shade don't share my confusion, electing to exchange furtive glances instead. Yet again, I'm in the dark, and I don't like it one bit. But this time it's my own brother and best friend keeping secrets, not an evil queen and scheming prince. Somehow, this hurts more. Scowling, I glare at them both until they realize I'm waiting for answers. Killorn grits his teeth and has the good sense to look apologetic. He gestures to Shade, passing the blame. You know more than I do.
The guard likes to play things close to the chest, and rightfully so.
Shade adjusts himself, sitting up a little more. He hisses at the motion, clutching at his wounded shoulder, but waves me off before I can help him.
We want to look small, broken, disorganized.
I can't help but snort, eyeing his bandages.
Well, you're doing a terrific job.
Don't be cruel, Mare. Shade snaps back, sounding very much like our mother. I'm trying to tell you that things aren't so bad as they seem. Nairsi was not our only stronghold, and Farley is not our only leader. In fact, she's not even true command. She's just a captain. There are others like her, and even more above her. Judging by the way she orders around her soldiers, I would think Farley was an empress. When I chance another glance at her, she's busy redoing a bandage, all while scolding the nurse who originally set the wound. But my brother's conviction can't be ignored. He knows much more than I do about the Scarlet Guard, and I'm inclined to believe what he says about them is true. There's more to this organization than what I see here. It's encouraging and frightening.
The Silvers think they're two steps ahead of us, but they don't even know where we stand.
Shade continues, his voice full of fervor.
We seem weak because we want to.
I turn back quickly. Maven tricked you, trapped you, slaughtered you, and ran you out of your own house. Or are you going to try and tell me that was all a part of another plan?
Mare,
Killorn mumbles, putting his shoulder against mine in a display of comfort, but I shove him away. He needs to hear this too. I don't care how many secret tunnels and boats and bases you have. You're not going to win against him, not like this. Tears I didn't know I still had sting my eyes, prickling at Maven's memory. It's hard to forget him as he was.
No,
as he pretended to be. The kind, forgotten boy. The shadow of the flame.
Then, what do you suggest, Lightning Girl?
Farley's voice shocks through me like my own sparks, setting every nerve on edge. For a brief, blistering second, I stare at my hands knotted in Shade's sheets. Maybe she'll leave if I don't turn around. Maybe she'll let me be.
Don't be such a fool, Mare Barrow.
Fight fire with fire, I tell her as I stand. Her height used to intimidate me. Now glaring up at her feels natural and familiar.
Is that some kind of silver joke?
She sneers, crossing her arms.
Do I look like I'm joking?
She doesn't reply, and that's answer enough. In her silence, I realize the rest of the compartment has gone quiet. Even the injured stifle their pain to watch the Lightning Girl challenge their captain.
You thrive on looking weak and striking hard,
yes? Well, they do everything they can to look strong, to seem invincible. But in the arena, I proved they are not.
Again, stronger, so everyone can hear you.
I call on the firm voice Lady Blanos brought to life in me.
They are not invincible.
Farley isn't stupid and finds it easy to follow my train of thought.
You're stronger than they are,
she says, matter of fact. Her eyes stray to Shade, lying tense in his bunk.
And you're not the only one who is.
I nod sharply, pleased that she already knows what I want. Hundreds of names, hundreds of Reds with abilities, stronger, faster, better than they are, with blood as red as the dawn. My breath catches, as if it knows it stands on the edge of the future. Maven will try to kill them, but if we get to them first, they could be the greatest army this world has ever seen. Farley's eyes glass at the thought. An army of new bloods. When she smiles, her scar strains against its stitches, threatening to split open again. Her grin widens. She doesn't mind the pain. But I certainly do. I suppose I always will. 4. Farley's not as tall as Killorn, but her steps are faster, more deliberate, and harder to keep up with. I do my best, almost jogging to match her pace through the immersive corridor. Like before, the guardsmen jump out of our way, but now they salute her as we pass, clasping hands to their chest or fingers to their brow. I must say, Farley cuts an impressive figure, wearing her scars and wounds like jewels. She doesn't seem to mind the blood on her shift, absently wiping her hands against it. Some of it belongs to Shade. She dug the bullet out of his shoulder without blinking. "We didn't lock him up, if that's what you think," she says lightly, as if talk of imprisoning Cal is casual gossip. I'm not stupid enough to rise to that bait, not now. She's feeling me out, testing my reaction, my allegiance, but I'm no longer the girl who begged for her help. I'm not so easily read anymore. I've lived on a razor wire, balancing lie after lie, hiding myself. It's nothing to do the same now and bury my thoughts deep down. So I laugh instead, pasting on the smile I perfected in Ilara's court. "I can tell. Nothing's been melted," I reply, gesturing to the metal walls. I read her as she tries to read me. She masks her expression well, but surprise still flickers in her eyes. Surprise and curiosity. I haven't forgotten the way she treated Cal on the train, with shackles, armed guards, and disdain. And he took it like a kicked dog. After his brother's betrayal and his father's murder, he had no fight inside him. I didn't blame him. But Farley doesn't know his heart or his strength like I do. She doesn't know how dangerous he really is. Or how dangerous I am, for that matter. Even now, despite my many injuries, I feel power deep inside, calling out to the electricity pulsing through the immersive. I could control it if I wanted. I could shut this whole thing down. I could drown us all. The lethal idea makes me blush, embarrassed by such thoughts. But they are a comfort all the same. I'm the greatest weapon of all on a ship full of warriors, and they don't seem to know it. We seem weak because we want to. Shade was talking about the guard when he said that, explaining their motives. Now I wonder if he wasn't also trying to convey a message. Like words hidden in a letter, long ago. Cal's bunk room is at the far end of the immersive, tucked away from the bustle of the rest of the vessel. His door is nearly hidden behind a twist of pipes and empty crates stamped with Archeon, Haven, Corvium, Harbor Bay, Delphi, and even Bellium, from Piedmont to the south. What the crates once held I can't say, but the names of the Silver Cities send a twinge down my spine. Stolen. Farley notices me staring at the crates but doesn't bother to explain. Despite our shaky agreement over what she calls New Bloods, I still haven't entered her inner circle of secrets. I suppose Cal has something to do with that. Whatever powers the ship, a massive generator by the feel of it, rumbles beneath my feet, vibrating into my bones. I wrinkle my nose in distaste. Farley might not have locked Cal up, but she's certainly not being kind either. Between the noise and the shaking sensation, I wonder if Cal was able to sleep at all. "I suppose this is the only place you could put him," I ask, glaring at the cramped corner. She shrugs, banging a hand on his door. "The prince hasn't complained." We don't wait long, though I'd very much like the time to collect myself. Instead, the wheel lock spins in seconds, clanking round at great speed. The iron hinges grate, screaming, and Cal pulls open the door. I'm not surprised to see him standing tall, ignoring his own aches. After a lifetime preparing to be a warrior, he's used to cuts and bruises, but the scars within are something he doesn't know how to hide. He avoids my gaze, focusing on Farley, who doesn't notice or doesn't care about the prince with a shattered heart. Suddenly, my wounds seem a bit easier to bear.
Captain Farley, he says, as if she's disturbed him at dinner time. He uses annoyance to mask his pain.
Farley won't stand for it and tosses her short hair with a sniff. She even reaches to close the door.
Oh, did you not want a visitor? How rude of me.
I'm quietly glad I didn't let Killorn tag along. He'd be even worse to Cal, having hated him since they first met back in the stilts.
Farley, I tell her through gritted teeth.
My hand stops the door short. To my delight and distaste, she flinches away from my touch. She flushes horribly, embarrassed with herself and her fear. Despite her tough exterior, she's just like her soldiers, afraid of the Lightning Girl. I think we're fine from here. Something twitches in her face, a twinge of irritation as much with herself as me. But she nods, grateful to be out of my presence. With one last daggered glance at Cal, she turns and disappears back down the corridor. Her barked orders echo for a moment, indecipherable but strong. Cal and I stare after her, then at the walls, then at the floor, then at our feet, afraid to look at each other, afraid to remember the last few days. The last time we watched each other across the doorway, dancing lessons and a stolen kiss followed. That might as well be another life. Because it was. He danced with Marina, the lost princess, and Marina is dead. But her memories remain. When I walk past, my shoulder brushing one firm arm, I remember the feel and smell and taste of him. Heat and wood smoke and sunrise. But no longer. Cal smells like blood. His skin is ice, and I tell myself I don't want to taste him ever again.
They've been treating you well?
I speak first, reaching for an easy topic. One glance around his small yet clean compartment is answer enough, but I might as well fill the silence.
Yes, he says, still hovering by the open door, debating whether to shut it.
My eyes land on a panel in the wall, pried back to reveal a tangle of wires and switches beneath. I can't help but smile softly. Cal's been tinkering.
You think that's smart? One wrong wire.
That draws a weak but still comforting smile from him.
I've been fooling with circuitry for half my life. Don't worry. I know what I'm doing.
Both of us ignore the double meaning, letting it slide past. He finally decides to shut the door, though he leaves it unlocked. One hand rests on the metal wall, fingers splayed, looking for something to hold on to. The flame maker bracelet still winks on his wrist. Bright silver against dull, hard gray. He notes my gaze and pulls down one stained sleeve. I guess no one thought to give him a change of clothes.
As long as I stay out of sight, I don't think anyone will bother with me,
he says, and goes back to fiddling with the open panel.
It's kind of nice, but the joke is hollow.
I'll make sure it stays that way, if that's what you want, I add quickly. In truth, I have no idea what Cal wants now, beyond vengeance, the one thing we still have in common. He corks an eyebrow at me, almost amused.
Oh, is the Lightning Girl in charge now?
He doesn't give me a chance to respond to the jibe, closing the distance between us in a single long step.
I get the feeling you're just as cornered as me.
His eyes narrow.
Only you don't seem to know it.
I flush, feeling angry and embarrassed.
Cornered? I'm not the one hiding in a closet.
No, you're too busy being put on parade.
He leans forward, and the familiar heat between us returns.
again.
Part of me wants to slap him. My brother would never, I thought my brother would never, and look where that got us, he thunders, throwing his arms wide.
The tips of his fingers touch either wall, scraping up against the prison he's found himself in.
The prison I put him in. And he's caged me in with him, whether he knows it or not.
Blazing heat flares from his body, and I have to step back a little.
He doesn't miss the action and deflates, letting his eyes and arms drop.
Sorry, he bites out, brushing a lock of black hair off his forehead.
Never apologize to me. I don't deserve it.
He glances at me sidelong, his eyes dark and wide, but he doesn't argue.
Heaving a breath, I lean back against the far wall. The space between us gapes like open jaws.
What do you know about a place called Tuck?
Grateful for the change in conversation, he pulls himself together, retreating into a prince's persona. Even without a crown, he seems regal, with perfect posture and his hands folded behind his back.
Tuck?
He repeats, thinking hard. A crease forms between his thick, dark brows. The longer it takes him to speak, the better I feel. If he doesn't know about the island, then few else will.
Is that where we're going?
It is. I think. A cold thought ripples through me, remembering Julian's lessons hard learned in the court and the arena.
Anyone can betray anyone.
According to Shade. Cal lets my uncertainty hang in the air, kind enough not to prod at it.
I think it's an island, he finally says. One of several off the coast. It's not Norton territory, nothing to warrant a settlement or base. Not even for defense, it's just open ocean out there.
A bit of the weight on my shoulders lifts. We'll be safe for now.
Good, good.
Your brother, he's like you. It's not a question.
Different.
He is.
What else is there to say?
And he's all right? I remember he was injured.
Even without an army, Cal is still a general, caring for the soldiers and the wounded.
He's fine, thank you. Took a few bullets for me, but he's recovering well.
At the mention of bullets, Cal's eyes flicker over me, finally allowing himself to look at me fully.
He lingers on my scraped face and the dried blood around my ears.
And you?
I've had worse.
Yes, we have.
We lapse into silence, not daring to speak further. But we still continue to stare at each other. Suddenly his presence is difficult to stand, and yet I don't want to go.
The Mersive has other ideas.
Beneath my feet the generator shudders, its pounding pulse changing rhythm.
We're almost there,
I mutter, sensing electricity flow, or ebb, to different parts of the craft. Cal doesn't feel it yet, unable to, but he doesn't question my instincts. He knows my abilities firsthand, better than anyone on the ship, better than my own family. For now, at least. Mom, Dad, Gisa, the boys, they're waiting for me on the island. I'll see them soon. They're here. They're safe. But how long I'll be with them, I don't know. I won't be able to stay on the island, not if I want to do something for the New Bloods. I'll have to go back to Norta, to use whatever and whoever Farley can give me to try and find them. It already seems impossible. I don't even want to think about it. And yet my mind buzzes, trying to form a plan. An alarm sounds overhead, synchronizing with a yellow light that starts to flash over Cal's door.
Amazing. I hear him mutter,
distracted for a moment by the great machine all around us. I don't doubt he wanted to explore, but there's no room for the inquisitive prince here. The boy who buried himself in manuals and built cycles from scratch has no place in this world.
I killed him, just as I killed Marina.
Despite Cal's mechanically inclined mind and my own electrical sense, we have no idea what comes next. When the Mersive angles, nosing up out of the depths of the ocean, the whole room tips. The surprise of it knocks us both off our feet. We collide with the wall and each other. Our wounds bang together, drawing pained hisses from us both. The feel of him hurts more than anything else. A deep stab of memory, and I scramble away quickly. Wincing, I rub one of my many bruises. Where's Sarah Skonos when you need her? I grumble, wishing for the skin healer who could mend us both. She could chase away the aches with a single touch, returning us both to fighting form. More pain crosses Cal's face, but not from his injuries. Well done, Mayor. Wonderful job bringing up the woman who knew his mother was murdered by the Queen, the woman no one believed. Sorry, I didn't mean... He waves me off and finds his feet, one arm pressed against the wall for balance. It's fine, she's... The words are thick, stilted. I chose not to listen to her. I didn't want to listen, that was my fault. I met Sarah Skonos only once, when Evangeline almost exposed me to our entire training session. Julian summoned her. Julian, who loved her. And watched as she mended my bloody face and bruised back. Her eyes were sad, her cheeks hollow, her tongue missing entirely. Taken for words spoken against the Queen, for a truth no one believed. Ilara killed Cal's mother, Corianne the Singer Queen, Julian's own sister, Sarah's best friend, and no one seemed to mind. It was so much easier to look away. Maven was there too, hating Sarah with every breath. I know now that was a crack in his shield, revealing who he truly was beneath practiced words and gentle smiles. Like Cal, I didn't see what was right in front of me. Like Julian, she is probably dead already. Suddenly, the metal walls and the noise and the popping of my ears are too much. I need to get off this thing. Despite the strange angle of the room and the persistent ringing in my head, my feet know what to do. They have not forgotten the mud of the stilts, the nights spent in alleys, or the obstacle courses of training. I wrench the door open, gasping for breath like a girl drowned. But the stale, filtered air of the immersive offers me no respite. I need the smell of trees, water, spring rains, even summer heat or winter snow. Something to remind me of the world beyond this suffocating tin can. Cal gives me a head start before following, his footsteps heavy and slow behind me. He's not trying to catch up, but give me space. If only Kaloran could do the same. He approaches from farther down the corridor, using handholds and wheel locks to ease himself down the angled craft. His smile fades at the sight of Cal, replaced not by a scowl, but by cold indifference. I suppose he thinks ignoring the prince will anger him more than outright hostility. Or perhaps Kaloran doesn't want to test a human flamethrower in such close quarters. "We're surfacing," he says, reaching my side. I tighten my grip on a nearby grate, using it to steady myself. "You don't say." Kaloran grins, leaning against the wall in front of me. He plants his feet on either side of mine. A challenge if there ever was one. I feel Cal's heat behind me, but the prince seems to be taking the indifferent path as well and says nothing. I won't be a piece in whatever game they're playing. I've done that enough for a lifetime. "How's what's her name? Lena." The name hits Kaloran like a slap. His grin slackens, one side of his mouth drooping. "She's fine, I guess." "That's good, Kaloran." I give him a friendly, if condescending, pat on the shoulder. The deflection works perfectly. We should be making friends. The immersive levels out beneath us, but no one stumbles. Not even Cal, who is nowhere near my balance or Kaloran's sea legs, hard-earned on a fishing boat. He's taut as a wire, waiting for me to take the lead. It should make me laugh, the thought of a prince deferring to me, but I'm too cold and worn to do much of anything but carry on. So, I do. Down the corridor, with Cal and Kaloran in tow, to the throng of guardsmen waiting by the ladder that brought us down here in the first place. The wounded go first, tied onto makeshift stretchers and hoisted up into the open night. Farley supervises, her shift even bloodier than before. She makes for a grim sight, tightening bandages with a syringe between her teeth. A few of the worse off get shots as they pass,
medication to help with the pain of being moved up the narrow tube. Shade is the last of the injured, leaning heavily on the two guardsmen who teased Killorn about the nurse. I would push through to him, but the crowd is too tight, and I don't want any more attention today. Still too weak to teleport, he has to fumble on one leg and blushes furiously when Farley straps him onto a stretcher. I can't hear what she says to him, but it calms him somewhat. He even waves off her syringe, instead gritting his teeth against the jarring pain of being hoisted up the ladder. Once Shade is safely carried up, the process goes much faster. One after the other, guardsmen follow one another up the ladder, slowly clearing the corridor. Many of them are nurses, men and women marked by white shifts with varying degrees of bloodstains. I don't waste time waving others ahead, faking politeness like a lady should. We're all going to the same place. So when the crowd clears a little, the ladder opening to me, I hurry forward. Cal follows, and his presence, combined with mine, parts the guardsmen like a knife. They step back quickly, some even stumbling, to give us our space. Only Farley stands firm, one hand around the ladder. To my surprise, she offers Cal and me a nod. Both of us. That should have been my first warning. The steps on the ladder burn in my muscles, still strained from Naersi, the arena, and my capture. I can hear a strange howling up above, but it doesn't deter me in the slightest. I need to get out of the Mersive as fast as possible. My last glimpse of the Mersive looking back over my shoulder is strange, angling over Farley and into the medical station. There are wounded still in there, motionless beneath their blankets. No, not wounded, I realize as I pull myself up. Dead. Higher up the ladder, the wind sounds, and a bit of water drips down. Nothing to bother with, I assume, until I reach the top in the open circle of darkness. A storm howls so strongly that the rain pelts sideways, missing most of the tube and ladder. It stings against my scraped face, drenching me in seconds. Autumn storms. Though I cannot recall a storm so brutal as this, it blows through me, filling my mouth with rain and biting salty spray. Luckily, the Mersive is tightly anchored to a dock I can barely see, and it holds firm against the roiling gray waves below. This way! A familiar voice yells in my ear, guiding me off the ladder and onto the Mersive hull slick with rain and seawater. Through the darkness, I can barely see the soldier leading me, but his massive bulk and his voice are easy to place. Bree! I close my hand on his, feeling the calluses of my oldest brother's grip. He walks like an anchor, heavy and slow, helping me off the Mersive and onto the dock. It's not much better, metal eaten with rust, but it leads to land, and that's all I care about. Land and warmth, a welcome respite after the cold depths of the ocean and my memories. No one helps Cal down from the Mersive, but he does fine on his own. Again, he's careful to keep some distance, walking a few respectable paces behind us. I'm sure he hasn't forgotten his first meeting with Bree back in the stilts, when my brother was anything but polite. In truth, none of the Barrows cared for Cal, except Mom and maybe Gisa, but they didn't know who he was then. Should be an interesting reunion. The storm makes Tuck difficult to see, but I can tell the island is small, covered in dunes and tall grass as tumultuous as the waves. A crack of lightning out on the water illuminates the night for a moment, showing the path in front of us. Now out in the open, without the cramped walls of the Mersive or the undertrain, I can see we number less than 30, including the wounded. They head for two flat concrete buildings where the dock meets land. A few structures stand out on the gentle hill above us, looking like bunkers or barracks. But what lies beyond them, I can't say. The next bolt of lightning, closer this time, shivers delightfully in my nerves. Bree mistakes it for cold and draws me closer, draping one heavy arm across my shoulders. His weight makes it hard to walk, but I endure. The end of the dock cannot come fast enough. Soon I'll be inside, dry, on solid ground, and reunited with the Barrows after far too long. The prospect is enough to get me through the bustle of wet activity. Nurses load the wounded onto an old transport, its storage bed covered in waterproof canvas. It was certainly stolen, as was everything else. The two buildings on land are hangars, their doors ajar enough to reveal more transports waiting inside. There's even a few boats anchored to the dock, bobbing in the gray waves as they ride out the storm. Everything is mismatched. Outdated transports in varying sizes, sleek new boats, some painted silver, black, one green. Stolen, or hijacked, or both. I even recognize the clouded gray and blue, the Norton Navy colors. On one boat, Tuck is like a much larger version of Will Whistle's old wagon, packed with bits and pieces of trade and thievery. The medical transport putters off before we reach it, fighting through the rain and up the sandy road. Only Bree's nonchalance keeps me from quickening my pace. He isn't worried about shade or what lies at the top of the hill, so I try not to be too. Cal doesn't share my sentiment, and finally speeds up so he can walk next to me. It's the storm or the darkness, or maybe simply his silver blood making him look so pale and afraid. "This can't last," he mutters, low enough so only I can hear.
"What's that, Prince?"
Bree says, his voice a dull roar. I nudge him in the ribs, but it doesn't do much more than bruise my elbow.
"No matter. We'll know soon enough."
His tone is worse than his words. Cold, brutal. So unlike the laughing brother I used to know. The guard has changed him, too. "Bree, what are you talking about?" Cal already knows and stops in his tracks, his eyes on me. The wind musses his hair, pasting it to his forehead. His bronze eyes darken with fear, and my stomach churns at the sight. "Not again," I plead. "Tell me I haven't walked into another trap." One of the hangars looms behind him, its doors opening wide on strangely quiet hinges. Too many soldiers to count step forward in unison, as regimented as any legion, their guns ready and eyes bright in the rain. Their leader might as well be a shiver, with almost white blonde hair and an icy disposition, but he's as red-blooded as I am. One of his eyes is clouded crimson, bleeding beneath the lens.
"Bree, what is this?"
I yell, rounding on my brother with a visceral snarl. Instead, he takes my hands in his, and not gently. He holds me firm, using his superior strength to keep me from pulling away. If he were anyone else, I would shock him good. But this is my brother. I can't do that to him. I won't.
"Bree, let me go."
"We won't hurt him,"
he says, repeating it over and over.
"We're not going to hurt him, I promise you."
So this isn't my cage. But that doesn't calm me at all. If anything, it makes me more angry and desperate. When I look back, Cal's fists are aflame, his arms stretched wide to face the blood-eyed man.
"Well?"
He growls in challenge, sounding more like an animal than a man. A cornered animal. Too many guns, even for Cal. They'll shoot him if they must. It might even be what they want. An excuse to kill the fallen prince. Part of me, most of me, knows they would be justified in this. Cal was a hunter of the Scarlet Guard, essentially guaranteeing Tristan's death, Walsh's suicide, and Farley's torture. Soldiers killed at his orders, wiping out most of Farley's rebel force, and who knows how many he sent to die on the war front, trading red soldiers for a few measly miles of the Lakelands. He owes no allegiance to the cause. He is a danger to the Scarlet Guard. But he is a weapon, as well as I am, one we can use in the days to come. For the New Bloods, against Maven, a torch to help lift the darkness.
"He can't fight out of this, Mare."
That's Killorn, choosing the worst of moments to sidle back. He whispers in my ear, acting like this closeness can influence me. "He'll die if he tries." His logic is hard to ignore.
"On your knees, Tiberius," the blood-eyed man says, taking bold steps toward the flaming prince.
Steam rises from his fire, as if the storm is trying to stamp him out.
"Hands behind your head."
Cal does neither, and he flinches at the mention of his birth name. He stands firm, strong, proud, though he knows the battle is lost. Once he might have surrendered, trying to save his own skin. Now he believes that skin worthless. Only I seem to think otherwise. Cal, do as he says. The wind carries my voice so that the whole hangar hears. I'm afraid they can hear my heart, too, hammering like a drum in my chest. Cal! Slowly, reluctantly, a statue crumbling to dust. Cal sinks to his knees and his fire sputters out. He did the same thing yesterday, kneeling next to his father's decapitated corpse. The blood-eyed man grins, his teeth gleaming and straight. He stands over Cal with relish, enjoying the sight of a prince at his feet. Enjoying the power it gives him. But I am the Lightning Girl, and he knows nothing of true power. 5. They try to convince me it's for the best, but their poor excuses fall on unsympathetic ears. Killorn and Bree quickly use every argument they've been told to say. He's dangerous even to you. But I know better than any that Cal would never hurt me. Even when he had reason to, I feared nothing from him. He's one of them. We can't trust him. After what Maven's done to his legacy and reputation, Cal has nothing and no one but us now, even if he refuses to admit it. He is valuable, a general, a prince of Norta, and the most wanted man in the kingdom. That one gives me pause and strikes a chord of fear deep down. If the blood-eyed man decides to use Cal as leverage against Maven, to trade him or sacrifice him, it will take all I have to stop him. All my influence, all my power. And I don't know if it will be enough. So I do nothing but nod along with them, slowly at first, pretending to agree, pretending to be controlled, pretending to be weak. I was right. Shade was warning me before. Once again, he saw the turn of the tide long before it rolled in. Cal is power, fire made flesh, something to be feared and defeated. And I am lightning. What will they try to do to me if I don't play my part? I have not stepped into another jail, not yet, but I can feel the key in the lock, threatening to turn. Luckily, I have experience in this kind of thing. The blood-eyed man and his soldiers march Cal into the hangar, not stupid enough to try and bind his hands. But they never lower their guns or their guard, careful to keep their distance lest one of them be burned for their boldness. I can only watch, eyes wide but mouth shut, when the hangar door slides closed again, separating the two of us. They won't kill him, not until he gives them a reason. I can only hope Cal behaves. Go easy on him, I whisper, leaning into Bree's warmth. Even in the cold autumn rain, he feels like a furnace. Long years fighting on the northern front have made him immune to wet and cold. I think back to Dad's old saying, the war never leaves. Now I know it firsthand, though my war is very different from his. Bree pretends not to hear me, hurrying us both from the docks. Killorn follows close behind, his boots catching my heels once or twice. I resist the urge to kick him and focus on climbing the wooden steps leading to the barracks on the hill above. The steps are worn down, beaten by too many feet to count. How many came this way? I wonder. How many are here now? We crest the hill, and the island stretches out before us, revealing a military base larger than I expected. The barracks on the ridge was one of at least a dozen I see now, organized in two even rows separated by a long, concrete yard. It's flat and well-maintained, not like the steps or the dock. There's a white line painted down the middle of the yard, perfectly straight, leading away into the stormy night. What it goes to, I have no idea. The whole island has an air of stillness, momentarily frozen by the storm. Come the morning, when the rain breaks and the darkness lifts, I suppose I'll see the base in all its glory, and finally understand the people I'm dealing with. I'm developing a bad habit of underestimating others, particularly where the Scarlet Guard is concerned. And like Naerse, Tuck is far more than it seems. The cold I felt on the Mersive and in the rain persists, even when I'm ushered into the doorway of the barracks marked with a painted black 3. I'm cold in my bones, in my heart. But I can't let my parents see that for their sake. I owe them this much. They must think me whole, unbroken, unaffected by Cal's imprisonment and my own ordeals in a palace and an arena. And the guard must think I'm on their side, relieved to be safe. But aren't I? Didn't I swear an oath to Farley and the Scarlet Guard? They believe as I do, in an end to Silver Kings and Red Slaves. They sacrifice soldiers for me, because of me. They are my allies, my brethren, brothers and sisters in arms. But the blood-eyed man gives me pause. He is not Farley. She might be gruff and single-minded, but she knows what I've been through. She can be reasoned with. I doubt reason lives in the heart of the blood-eyed man. Killorn is strangely quiet. This silence is not like us at all. We're used to filling the space with insults, with teasing, or in Killorn's case, with utter nonsense. It's not in our nature to be quiet around each other, but now we have nothing to say. He knew what they planned to do to Cal, and agreed with it. Worse, he didn't even tell me. I would feel angry, but for the cold. It eats at my emotions, dulling them into something like the electrical hum in the air. Bree doesn't notice the strangeness between us. Not that he would. Besides being pleasantly foolish, my oldest brother left when I was a gangly 13-year-old who thieved for fun, not necessity, and wasn't so cruel as I've become. Bree doesn't know me as I am now, having missed almost 5 years of my life. But then, my life has changed more in the last 2 months than ever before. And only 2 people were with me through it. The first is imprisoned, and the second wears a crown of blood. Any sensible person would call them my enemies. Strange. My enemies know me best. And my family doesn't know me at all. Inside the barracks is blissfully dry, humming with lights and wires bundled along the ceiling. The thick concrete walls turn the corridor into a maze, with no markers to guide the way. Every door is shut, steel gray and unremarkable, but a few bear the signs of life within. Some woven beach grass adorning a knob, a broken necklace strung across a doorway, and so on. This place holds not just fearsome soldiers, but the refugees of Naerse and who knows where else. After the enactment of the measures, commanded from my own lips, many guardsmen and Reds alike fled the mainland. How could they stay, threatened by conscription and execution? But how did they manage to get away? And how did they make it here? Another question joins my steadily growing list. Despite my distraction, I keep careful notice of the twists and turns my brother takes. Right here, 1, 2, 3 corners, left by the door with prairie carved into it. Part of me wonders if he's taking a roundabout route on purpose, but Bree isn't smart enough for that. I guess I should be thankful. Shade would have no problems playing the trickster, but not Bree. He's brute strength, a rolling boulder, easy to dodge. He's a guardsman, too, freed from one army just to join another. And based on how he helped me on the docks, he owes his allegiance to the guard and nothing else. Trammy will probably be the same, always eager to follow and occasionally guide our older brother. Only Shade has the good sense to keep his eyes open, to wait and see what fate awaits us, new bloods. The door ahead of us stands ajar, as if waiting. Bree doesn't need to tell me this is our family's bunk, because there's a purple scrap of fabric tied around the doorknob. It's frayed at the edges and clumsily embroidered. Lightning bolts of thread spark across the rag, a symbol that is neither red nor silver, but mine. A combination of the colors of House Titanos, my mask, and the lightning that surges inside of me, my shield. As we approach, something wheels behind the door, and a bit of warmth moves through me. I would know the sound of my father's wheelchair anywhere. Bree doesn't knock.